We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quint Kasnick. And Quint, this is at least the second week in a row where I enter this podcast with this overwhelming sense of glee. We are coming off of Rivalry Weekend, and it had a bunch of other spicy ingredients mixed in, specifically these D1, D3 cross matches. We're recording this in the middle of Dartmouth's game against Tufts, and we'll talk about that later on in the podcast. But there's no question that we're going to talk about some big rivalry matchups that had meaningful impacts on the NCAA tournament field. We're coming off of a huge week of news as well, so we'll sprinkle some of those topics in throughout. But at first, I want to start by asking you, on the Hopkins Maryland broadcast yesterday, you talked about how Hopkins has rivalry games against Navy, Loyola, Towson, Virginia, Syracuse, basically North Carolina, Princeton. Prior to joining the Big Ten, pretty much every Hopkins game had some sort of rivalry component. But even among those, the Maryland game rose above. And I thought Jason Benetti did a great job on the broadcast with you. I thought he was incredibly prepared, given how little lacrosse he calls. But he pressed on what makes Maryland special when it comes to Johns Hopkins opponents. I'm not going to ask you that question, but more broadly, what makes a rivalry game a rivalry?
Well, I think it's based on history. I think it's based on two teams who have like goals, similar trajectories, who meet each other along the way year by year and play meaningful games. Teams who have won championships or traded championships, teams who have athletes who are recruited from similar high schools and similar regions. And it all builds like a fire, and it becomes this inferno. It was great to work with Jason. You know, I'd worked with Jason for 2 years, college football. He's a really an up and coming announcer, but he's also a special person. The best thing I picked up from Jason this week was he said to me Friday, we had a conversation after doing all our prep, and he's watched a lot of tape this week getting ready for it. And he goes, I don't know if he's done a lacrosse game since that Notre Dame Maryland indoor game a couple years ago. He was in the mix. He went to Syracuse. He cut his teeth broadcasting lacrosse in the slowdown era. And he said to me, he goes, the shot clock. I go, yeah. He goes, the shot clock has just made all these games off the charts. I'm like, yes, it has. And right now I'm riding a streak. Like, I'm not taking a shower this week because I'm riding, I think, 3 or 4, maybe even 5 consecutive games I've called, like 13-12, 11-10, 14-13, overtime, come down to the last minute. Like, we're in a period of lacrosse going back to 2019, I think, that is so fan friendly. I mean, there's action every 80 seconds, every minute. And the players have stepped up, the coaches have stepped up. I think the fans are really in a good spot. And man, I can't tell you how proud I am watching these games. The sport is, we're finally delivering to our potential.
Well, let's start with Syracuse, Virginia, because that's the game that over the last decade, 2 decades, when the slowdown era, as you called it, was reaching its pinnacle, we could always count on Syracuse, Virginia to deliver. And I think it's meaningful that a bunch of things happened in this game. First and foremost, it was moved to ESPN2, huge potential audience. Second, it had a Syracuse team that was reeling, coming off of a couple of blowout losses and the suspension of Chase Scanlon and a handful of significant injuries. Nick DiPietro not playing, Jacob Buttermore getting hurt during the practice this week. And yet, it is a rivalry game. We were getting it for the second time this season. And I picked the Orange primarily because Virginia seems to bring out the best in them. But I didn't expect what ultimately unfolded, which was a significant face-off advantage for Jacob Faup. And the Syracuse offense building on that early momentum, building a lead big enough to be able to hold off a late Virginia rush and securing a 13-11 victory. I wasn't able to watch this game as closely as I would have under normal circumstances. I was covering Army-Navy, and we'll get to that in a second. Obviously, you were preparing for the game that followed on ESPN2. But fortunately, I think this is actually kind of an easy game to analyze because it really was Faup giving such a possession advantage. He went 23 of 27, picked up 9 ground balls. Pete LaSala went 1 of 16. And the Faceoff contingent online was talking about how much improved Faup was over the course of the last month, but really, he was 22 of 33 in the first meeting that Syracuse won by 10 goals. It feels like maybe he's just got LaSala in particular and the Virginia Faceoff unit in general, he's just got their number.
Bingo. You nailed it. It's got to be a style thing. I'm sure that the Fogo Nation can break it down. But, you know, that was the story of this game. Clearly, he wins 24 of 27. Now, I thought Syracuse would play better. You know, everyone was, the world was crumbling around Syracuse. Well, I've been on teams that had off-field distractions. And they slow your growth. Cuse looked like it was hanging over them for not just that last game, but a couple games. And they rid themselves of that. And I think they asked a bunch of different players to step up through adversity, whether it be injuries or the removal of a player from the roster. And they all delivered. They should deliver. These are highly recruited, really good players. I just thought their mojo was outstanding, and they started winning faceoffs. And that's a team. You know, the possession disparity has been outlandish in their losses. I mean, it's not even fair when they're spotting teams 10, 15 possessions a game. And they flipped that switch. Thought they got off to a good start, provided some confidence, and they played a smart and well-coached game. I loved your line, your text to me. You said, the hungry dog runs the fastest, and they had more to play for. They really did. They were the hungry dog. So Cuse is back in the hunt quickly and dramatically, but shockingly in the narrative and the storyline that developed.
The most important moment of Syracuse's season for me heading into Saturday's game was their comeback against Duke, because even though it fell short, Cuse is Cuse, that idea, that motto, that phrase, it's true, but it's not true until you see it on a year-to-year basis. There isn't a Powell on this team. There isn't someone else that has that level of dynamic charisma and production and reliability. The man is kind of what I'm saying. And in the absence of that, until you see them with their back against the wall respond, I don't know that you can assume that they will in those circumstances. You know, I think back to the Kevin Rice, Dylan Donahue, Randy Stotts, when those guys were at their pinnacle. It was like they didn't have the multi-year career and the national championships that their predecessors had, but they still played like Syracuse. And I think that Duke game in Durham a couple weeks ago showed me that this team had that in them. And then, yes, they got blottoed by Notre Dame. They got blottoed by Carolina. But that's why I thought the combination of going to Charlottesville and what that has brought out of them in conjunction with recapturing that thing that they showed me earlier in the season was why I had confidence in them. On the flip side, Virginia, I was talking to a coach who remarked at the sideline hug among the coaching staff after their Carolina win. And he said to me, there was a lot in that hug, referring to some of the internal battles, chemistry-wise, relationship-wise, dynamics-wise, that had been fought leading up to that game. And I think the lesson for me is that in a week-to-week sport, just because you solve a problem doesn't mean that it's solved for good. And one of the things that I'm really interested in about this Virginia team is the correlation between Ian Laviano's production and their winning. He got held to one goal, and my theory is that when Ian Laviano does not score three or four goals, they don't get the emotional lift. They are playing, as you have pointed out rightly a handful of times, too much hero ball, and they're not getting production off of the greasy plays, the ground balls in front of the cage that come up orange and blue, and like I said, provide that juice that carries you over in a big game. And I think that now that they have this extended layoff until the NCAA tournament, they're going to be a completely different team by the time they play again. From an emotional standpoint, it could go one of two ways. I have no idea how to predict what we're going to see the next time the Cavaliers take the field.
Now, they're going to be seeded, what, four or five or six? Probably five or six.
I think definitely four or five. I mean, yeah, I guess okay. I hadn't accounted for the loss, but
I, yeah. No, if I was betting it, I would say five. you know, North Carolina's win today, and we'll see what happens. And, you know, that's a valid point. Again, every game, like the ball, you know, it starts with the ball and like who's willing to work really hard to get the ball. And you look at Cuse, like my confidence in their offense never wavered. Never. My confidence in Drake Porter, their goalie, never wavered. My confidence in their coaching staff, John Desco, his group, has never wavered. But you're starting this like week after week, you're saying, can they clear the ball? This defense off ball, can they cover people? Those are fixable items. Face off. It's a nuanced science. Can they really fix their Fogos? That's tricky stuff. That's complicated. I think you rely on the confident areas I thought they turned it up a notch on some of their effort plays, quite honestly, knowing that the margin for victory is not a dominant Cuse team. It's a good, very good Cuse team. But it's not like the old days when you had Gary and Paul to bail you out. You had Ryan and Casey and Mikey to bail you out. So, I thought they put more into some of those 50-50 ground balls. I thought they were super detailed in their clearing. And I thought their defense was much more buttoned up and understanding that, yeah, a little hesitation, a little bad step, a little missing of a check has ramifications. So they grew up and, in the league's very unforgiving. So I think that's Virginia's lesson. Virginia's 2-4 in the ACC.
And I think that that's another lesson that you can apply to all five teams, which is that these teams just beat each other. Overreacting to one game is probably going to do you more harm than good, whether you're a player, a parent, a coach, an analyst, a fan. You got to look at it in the aggregate, and we've got a couple weeks to do that. But you brought up defense. Let's move to the other end of the bubble conversation. It's only one slot away. There's a huge gap between bubble in and bubble out. Metaphorically and this year, as I describe it, literally, the Navy midshipmen beat the Army Black Knights 9-4. They limited Army to 3 goals while the game was actually in question. And you can analyze this game a number of ways. The way I characterize it was that it was a game with too many storylines. But the reason that Navy won is because they throttled that Army offense so specially. Now, of course, Spencer Reese made 19 saves, and you can't discount that. But I was surprised every time I checked his save total. It was a couple saves higher than I expected it to be, which the only explanation for that is that he was getting shots that were easily saved, right? When a goalie makes a bunch of highlight reel saves, you don't forget that. You overinflate his save total as opposed to undercount it. And on the post-game Zoom, I asked him what the defensive game plan was, and he basically said, we had 2 guys on each wing, and they were supposed to hedge down whenever Brennan Nickturn had the ball at X and was trying to dodge. Franchuk was on him, did a really nice job. Nickturn was held to 0 goals, 0 assists, 3 shots, and 3 turnovers, which is an incredible erasure for a guy who was squarely in the Tworten conversation early in the season. But it was not just the defensive performance, because the other side of Army's offense is their big dodging midfielders, really nice day out of Navy's short stick D middies. But once again, it was a game where Jacob Jarosz did a really nice job winning 10 of 17 at the faceoff X. And Navy did a fantastic job of not only extending their offensive possessions, but getting second chance opportunities off of rebounds. The number of times that the shot clock got reset and they turned a 70-second possession into a 150-second possession, it seemed, especially in the first half, when the half it was 3-1 at halftime, Navy was winning. Like, Navy had the ball for 25 of the 30 minutes. It was outrageous. And the combination of time of possession and the quality defense is what you attribute Army's offense being so throttled to. And it was just an exceptional day. Joe Amplo and his staff winning their first Army-Navy game. Amplo giving a lot of credit to John Orson for coming up with that game plan. Wanted it delivered last Sunday. Orson delivered it. It was complex, but they came up with drills that there were simple, and in an effort to simplify the game over the course of the week, drilled, and clearly executed it on game day.
So glad they could play this game in front of fans, over 5,000. Bill Belichick in the house talking to the Navy team. My brother's there sending me pictures with six of his classmates from the early 80s.
Who was like, the first person I saw when I walked in? You guessed it, yeah. Christian Sweezy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big game. It's a special game. It means a lot to so many people, whether they're associated with either of the academies, whether they're an Annapolis resident. Like, it's a big deal. Army took shots. Army ended up with 41 shots. It took 20 in the fourth quarter. Not John Orson deserves a lot of credit. So does Spencer Reese. The one thing that stands out to me is just Navy's overall athleticism. Navy's got horses now. Navy's got some young bucks. They got some really good athletes on that team. And they can stand toe-to-toe with Army. I don't know if that was the case for the last 3, 4, 5 years. The other thing that stands out is, you know, go back early in the season. Nick Turn was putting up giant numbers. And my question marks all along were, well, who else is there? Who else is there? If you shut him down, who else is there? And you're starting to see some development from some other players, but not enough. And clearly Navy took off, took Nick Turn out of the equation, and that brought Army's totals down. Again, this could be round one of a rematch. I think Army will move forward off of this game, but I loved Navy's contributions from some second line guys who had their moment in the sun. I love the pageantry about this game, and lacrosse needs Army Navy. Let me tell you that both teams are nationally relevant. Navy's climbing up my top 20 this week, and Army's still with their Syracuse win. They're still in the hunt for that the at large if they can't take the Patriot League.
So you mentioned second line contributions, and we can't talk about this game without talking about Joe DeLyra, one of the few seniors that contributed at the offensive end. Christian Daniel, the lone senior in the top six offensively for Navy, was really well blanketed by Marcus Hudgens, who I thought had a tremendous game. And Coach Joe Alberici talked about post-game the fact that he felt like Army's defense actually played really well. But DeLyra scored the game's first goal. He scored the goal to make it 5-2 in the third quarter to respond to Army's first goal of the second half. And then he scored, I believe, to make it 7-3, again, responding to an Army goal that could have potentially brought the game back to life. So three huge momentum goals. This is a guy who was a scout team player as recently as 3 weeks ago. But Brad Ross had seen something in him over the course of the last month leading up to 2 weeks ago and inserted him into the starting lineup. And Joe Amplo called it, both to Bill Wagner, the Annapolis Capital reporter, before the game, and then, or during, you know, in the week leading up to this game, excuse me. And then in pregame, he gave a story. He told us afterward that he was walking around the locker room all intense and fired up and, you know, flustered or whatever. And DeLyra said to him, "Hey, coach, calm down." And Amplo said to him, "Why don't you score a goal and calm me down?" And then, of course, he goes out and scores the first goal of the game. I mean, just a storybook for a senior who hadn't scored a goal all season leading into the game.
Yeah, you know, this is the time of year. And I think it's maybe a little further down the timeline that we're seeing freshmen at some places finally make their way, finally learn the schemes, develop confidence. And you typically see some seniors or some veteran players who have had enough, who have practiced so well that the coach says, you know, we're going to have to play him. Like, they play their way. And then they're almost playing, what are you going to do, bench me? I've been benched for 3 years. You know, so what? And they play with this attacking attitude. Like, you know, I sat the bench for 3 years. I finally got my shot. I'm not going to pass the ball to the next guy. I'm going to go to the goal. I got nothing to lose. You know. So I love this time of year when you talk to coaches and you watch games and you see, like, who is this guy? Why is this guy Camulay playing on extra man at Duke? Well, because he's been scoring all week on this one play they run. And guess what? They run the play, he wins the game. Like, you know, so what we don't see Monday through Friday matters so much. And sometimes we wonder, like, why is this guy getting reps? Well, it's usually an indication that he's doing great in practice.
Let's move on to your game. At Homewood Field, the Maryland Terrapins built, what was it, a 9-4 lead?
5-0. I don't have my score sheet. Yeah, I mean, the way I break this game down, Terry, like, Maryland dominated the first 10 minutes and the last 3 minutes. And in between, I thought Hopkins kind of had the edge. You know, totally. That's the majority of the game. But between the 5-0 run to start and the 3-0 run to end, there's the difference.
So I thought that if you were going to, and this isn't to take away from the performances of Connor DeSimone, who had 3-1, or Joey Epstein, who had 1-3, but Garrett Deignan's 3 goals were tactically, to me, very important in this game because of the way that it created a spread in the Maryland defense and, I think, facilitated a lot of the other goals that Hopkins scored during that middle stretch of the game when they came back from the early deficit and built the late lead. They were up 12-10, I believe, or 13-11 before, as you say, that's when Logan Wisnoskis and Jared Bernhardt, both of whom finished with 4-1, really came to life and made the plays down the stretch that showed that for the first time this year, Maryland was tested and they were able to respond and finish the season 10-0. They'd already secured the number one seed in the Big Ten tournament. I don't know whether or not they're in line for a number one seed in the NCAA tournament, but either they have the narrow track on it or they're not going to get it, which is a conversation for another day because we don't know how this committee is going to operate. But ultimately, I take a lot of promise from what Maryland showed relative to this was the closest game they played all season. It was the first time they played a four-quarter game, really.
It's a huge learning experience. You know, it's interesting how you mentioned those Deignan goals because he can really rip it. And I almost think that Maryland's defense you kind of become your defense based on what you face in practice every day, and that's your offense. And so they tend to pack it in. I thought Hopkins did a good job packing it in against Maryland's defense and trying to deny those crease looks, kind of baiting the step downs. And the Terps just didn't want to get involved for the most part with the step down game. I thought that was there. The step down, or even then the one more across the top for a re-dodge or outside shot. But, you know, they've been the kings of the layups and the dunks with their high shooting percentage. So it's hard to believe that Hopkins is 2-8 with the offensive talent that they have. Ultimately, though, the inability to close a game and win a winnable game becomes systemic. And that's a problem. That's hard to turn around. And I do think Maryland takes a giant step forward. Okay. They had beaten Hopkins handily in the first matchup, even though it's a rivalry game. I think it was harder for them to get up for this game. They started great and then kind of took their foot off the gas pedal. I thought their weaknesses were exposed here, though. You know, face-offs going to be an issue against a really good face-off team. Scoring outside of Dodgers, outside of Jared Bernhardt. I don't know the depth of contribution on that roster is equal to what we're seeing from a Carolina or a Duke. Defense I liked. I like them off the carpet especially. Didn't generate as much transition as you'd probably like from some of their stops. But, Maryland's a well-coached team. Again, I think they move forward off of this. They have some time off now. They won't play again until the semifinals on May 6th, which I think that will help them. I think that this close game goes a long way. They hadn't had to defend a tense possession late in the game. They hadn't had to use their 10-man ride. They hadn't had to score a goal, like with their backs up against the wall. So this is great. They are both, all those factors are long-term positive growth indicators.
I'm higher on the Terps than you are for a variety of reasons. I think that they're athleticism and their rope unit is really underrated, not often discussed. I think John Gepper played an exceptional game.
20 flashed incredibly. I actually texted Bob Benson and I last night. We're going back and forth. I'm like, who's this 20 kid? He's really only like a true sophomore. I think he's going to go to graduate school. He's got 2 more years. He switched from midi to pole. He gave up 2 goals on some off the ball stuff if you watch the tape. But man, I think he's a pro down the line. He runs exceptionally well. His handle is great. They clean up some of his defense. I think he's got the ability to be a pro pole.
They were playing without Jake Higgins, who has been really good for most of the year. Roman Puglisi is one of the best known quantities of short stick D-Mitty. I think Alex Smith is awesome because he's tall and strong, so he doesn't get bodied up. That depth at the long stick midi position, I'm sorry, at the rope position, long and short stick D-Mitties, I think is where the majority of my confidence in their ability to match up in the NCAA tournament comes from. The depth of scoring does not bother me nearly as much as it bothers you. I don't think it matters from a consistency standpoint in the tournament. I think it matters in flashes. You need a guy who can give you 3 goals that is not on the opponent's scouting report. And I think that Maryland will have that in crunch time. But the other thing you need is And I think that this is where, again, the largest source of my confidence in terms of their ability to beat an ACC team in the quarterfinals or the semifinals comes from, is you need the guy that's going to make the play late in the game. And Jarrett Bernhardt, to me, is the best player in college lacrosse. I don't think lacrosse is a sport where the team with the best player wins as often as, say, basketball. But I do think that it occurs more than, say, football. And I think that betting against Jarrett Bernhardt is something that I'm not going to want to do in May. So those are the reasons, in addition to the fact that I like McNaney. I think, you know, when you talk about Defensive Player of the Year, like, there are people who will bring up Grill and Makar, right? And so that's, you know, kind of second to only Notre Dame in terms of teams that have that level of, you know, versatility down low. So I just think that there's a lot that they've shown. But ultimately, like, yeah, I agree with you. They really haven't been tested. I'm counting on the fact that they've got at least one, if not two, additional gears that they haven't shown yet.
Okay. That's fair. And I kind of agree with everything you're saying. My one thing is to put their Big Ten in perspective this year. I think Big Ten defenses this year are really bad.
Yeah.
I across the conference. So.
And they Maryland might be, Maryland, but they also might not be.
17 goals in a legit playoff game. Like, there's a little bit of, you watch Penn State play Ohio State yesterday, and like, man, it's turnover city, the defense. Some of the fundamentals that you saw today defensively from Rutgers and Michigan kind of leave my head scratching. Like, man, is there any defense? Anyone in this league playing defense? Johns Hopkins, midfield defense. Like, so that's something that's got to be factored into the – baked into the equation here. Just keep that in mind, okay? It's not a – it's just a little something that's got my mind after seeing more Big Ten lacrosse this week than I had the prior, really most of the season.
We got to talk quickly about Penn State 10, Ohio State 9. The Buckeyes were up 9-8, and it was Dylan Folds late who got a couple goals to put the Nittany Lions ahead, set up an Ohio State faceoff with, I believe, like, I don't know, 20 seconds left. Trey LeClaire, ground ball at the top of the box, comes up with it, falling down, throws up a one-handed pass. I mean, it was a prayer. It was total desperation.
That was a blind heave that happened to go right to the guy's.
To Jack Myers, who puts a shot. I thought that it hit the post, but
a very good shot.
It was a very good shot.
Fayok made an incredible stop there. There's no way he's getting a stick on that, and he pushes off and makes a big step and makes the kick save. I'm so proud of that kid. You know, he was a super talented kid coming out of St. Mary's. I think he struggled to make the transition to college. I was there 2 years ago for a football game. I worked with him and Colby watching practice. John Hawes was hitting one of the shots. I was standing right behind him, and a really likable young man. And I think the success he had the prior week getting the W, I sent him a little Instagram note like, man, I'm so proud of you. You know what it feels like now. And I think you saw growth this week from him. I think you saw, hey, I can do this. Like, sometimes when a guy goes to college and doesn't start for a while, confidence is a big deal. Until you get out there and do it, you're like, oh, that's right, I'm pretty good at this. And he's very good. He's very good. So I give you credit. You never lost faith in him. And I'm so happy for him as a young man. His brother's coming in the pipeline too. So there's just little victories. You know, I was happy to see a kid like that make a gigantic save.
Couple quick games I want to get to on Sunday. North Carolina 12, Notre Dame 10. The Tobacco Road two-step did not treat the Fighting Irish any better than it treated the Denver Pioneers at the beginning of the season.
Whew, exciting game.
Yeah.
Love to see the fans and the sun shining and lots going on in this game. Notre Dame.
A lot of 11-year-olds that really liked taunting Griffin Westland, especially early in the game. The mics were picking that up, but I think it's trailed off a little bit as the broadcast went along.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Notre Dame failure Thursday against Duke, failure to scoop up first-time ground balls and clear the ball in the fourth quarter when you're tired. Thought we kind of saw the same thing on Sunday. Carolina's offense puts a lot of pressure on defenses. I like their strategy to get the ball behind the goal against this Notre Dame defense. They just got so many playmakers. Their second midfield, the Heels' second midfield, is on fire right now. I think they've outscored the first group or close to it over the last three games. Really seeing development out of that unit. And Carolina's defense in general has really tightened up after a couple efforts where you're like, what is going on down there? Much more organized. The shorties pushing people to the right areas. Krieg is solid as a rock. Bowen is stick handling. Just as gorgeous to watch. I thought their clearing, Carolina's clearing, was just beautiful to watch with that wide angle. The path of their middies, the cutting, the 20 yard passes thrown on a frozen rope. It was just beautiful to watch.
It was really fun, really exciting, and just kind of felt like one of those games that Notre Dame couldn't get over the hump in terms of exactly what you described, both cleaning up their clearing, but then also bringing it back to even. And once they fell behind, they basically trailed by two or three for the majority of the game. Also on Sunday, Michigan falls to Rutgers 13-12 in a game that you called the game really in many ways came down to a Wolverine extra man opportunity late in the game that they didn't convert. You pointed out that a timeout probably should have been called before they lost possession just to give the opportunity to reset and try to get a good look down the stretch. But ultimately, Rutgers was able to seal it. And once again, you know, kind of bookending the season, it was the Curse Brothers show. Colin and Nett, Connor with, I believe, 5 goals and an assist. And now Rutgers, like Maryland, has a break until May 6th when they will host the winner of the 4-5 game as the number 2 seed in the Big Ten tournament.
I want to get your opinion on the Rutgers game, because I was getting texts late in the game like, if Rutgers loses this game, they're going to put themselves in a situation where they're going to be on a bubble without quality wins. So as long as they keep holding serve against lesser teams in the Big Ten, I see them in the tournament. And I thought today's win was a big step in that direction, because you lose this game today to Michigan and then you come up short in the Big Ten tournament, all of a sudden the resume is not gonna stack up to some others. So this was essential to gut this one out.
No question. Ultimately, that's an impossible question to answer without knowing what. So speaking with Tim Leonard, the committee chair of the selection committee, in the end of March, the comment that he shared that stood out the most was the eye test is going to matter a lot more. And he put a strong emphasis on the word a lot. And you guys heard it on this podcast. But without knowing what a lot actually means, Rutgers will have a traditionally bubble RPI. They will have zero quality wins. And if they were to lose to Hopkins, Penn State, or Michigan, they would have a bad loss to a team certainly below 30, but at this point in the 50s from an RPI standpoint. Do those numbers matter? Like, we just don't know whether or not they matter. And the eye test, when we did our bracketology last week, we substituted the coaches poll, because the eye test from the 5-person committee's standpoint should be how the regional advisory committees inform them on who the good teams are. That's the process that the NCAA has created that should allow for some subjectivity without giving too much power to a group of 5 individuals. So you can, I think, rationally draw the line between the eye test equals the RAC feedback equals the USILA coaches poll, because it's the same coaches that are voting in the poll as are providing the feedback on these regional advisory committee calls.
That's scary.
Why?
If you ever look at that poll, that is scary. there is major because, conference bias in that poll.
Yes, that is major. True. But my point is, I don't know. Like, I mean, it's either the eye test that has Rutgers at 8, or it's the numbers that have them with a loss to a team in the 50s if they lose to one of those 3 squads I just named.
I know. That's why running the table against teams not named Maryland is critical. And they'll say, look, Big Ten's got a strong history in the NCAA tournament. If Maryland's their only loss, who's the number 1 or 2 team in the country, how do we keep this team out? You can't. So Rutgers deserves to get in the playoffs. I thoroughly agree with that. I was just sitting there saying, wow, if they lose this game, all of a sudden they're going to put themselves in the same scenario they've seen like 3 out of the last 4 years, where they're on that bubble out. They're like the first team out. I don't think that's going to happen this year. The Curse Brothers were really, really, really good today. That goalie's one, Collins, one of my favorite goalies in the country. I just his outlet passes are so aggressive. He's big. And then Connor with the outside shooting. Is there a better guy from like 14 yards with his feet set in the country? I mean, he's something else.
It makes you wonder why there aren't more 230-pound shooters all across the country.
Yeah, he can move. I don't know if he has a left hand. I don't think he needs it. I think it's a little there, but everything's right-handed over the top, changing levels or working the offside pipe. I think maybe there's one time on tape I've seen him all year where I was saying, oh, that was a little bit of a force. Like these bombs he's taken, I never say to myself, oh, that's a bad shot. Because these are good shots. And defenses really need to stretch to him. Rutgers attack is what it is. I like this team. I like this team. You know, faceoffs and defense are going to be their issues going forward.
Whipping around the rest of the country, the theme by and large was holding serve with a couple of exceptions we'll get to in a second. But within the CAA, Drexel 12, Hofstra 8, Delaware 16, Towson 8, those big results that will kind of push forward the narrative of that conference on a week-to-week basis. In the America East, UMBC with a huge 14-13 win over Stony Brook. Those teams have now played 5 overtimes combined in their 2 meetings. So they're essentially exactly even teams. One of the biggest upsets of the weekend, Binghamton 10, Vermont 7. Great defensive performance out of the Bearcats in order to hold the Catamounts to 7 goals. Another notable near miss. So High Point and Richmond both banked wins, but the SoCon had potential upheaval with Bellarmine looking like they were in a position to upset the Jacksonville Dolphins, but John Galloway's squad comes back and secures an 8-7 victory. Hobart 14, Merrimack 10, but of course the most important game in the NEC, St. Joe's 14, LIU 13. We've been talking about Taylor Ray's Hawks squad on either the last 2 or 3 podcasts. They continue with their winning ways. And then in the MAC, the most interesting story in the last week or so in college lacrosse, the Marist Red Foxes playing their first game in midweek since March 6th. They beat Quinnipiac 14-9. The Bobcats have since ceased their season. That news broke on Sunday due to COVID issues. They were first of all, every team makes the MAC tournament, but they were in contention for a second or a third seed. The Red Foxes continue their hot streak with a 14-7 win over Manhattan on Saturday night. It's crazy because on March 6th, Marist beat Detroit Mercy, which is a MAC member, 15-11. However, that game did not count as a conference game because MAC teams only played MAC teams, but they only counted one of the games as an actual MAC game, and that March 6th game didn't count. The playoff seeding is determined by number of wins, total wins. I don't know what the tiebreakers are, but it's not win percentage. So Marist has 2 MAC wins, so they will essentially finish second last in the conference because everybody else except for Siena has more than 2 wins. So a crazy quirk that could, I think, if I'm doing the math quickly in my head correctly, see them rematched against Manhattan in the quarterfinals of the MAC tournament, which is not a welcome reward to Andy Kelleher's, Drew Kelleher's Jasper squad on the basis of the way that they've performed all season. But it looks like Monmouth is going to have the number one seed in that conference tournament. Quint, crazy action all across college lacrosse. How do you
react? Coin tosses in the Big Ten.
Yes, coin tosses. I love it. Tails never fails.
We got awkward seeding in the MAC. We got the change of the tournament format in the Patriot League. It's also 2021, isn't it?
It is. So let's finish this conversation by talking about what we can and should learn from these D1 versus D3 games. So on Friday night, Penn went to Cabrini and handled the 2019 D3 National Champions a 23-9 loss. They did so without Sam Hanley, who was held out due to, I believe I'm allowed to report this, a false positive COVID test. And then on Sunday afternoon, the Tufts Jumbos, who put up 31 on Bates on Saturday, beat Dartmouth 15-9 in Hanover, New Hampshire. They are now 5-0 in an absolute buzzsaw. this is by far their lowest goal total of the season. Dartmouth playing with an extremely limited roster, given all the players who aren't on campus this semester, which is just part of a university policy. So people love debating D1 versus D3 in lacrosse. I don't know if you have like a standard opinion on this, but is there anything about these two games that are going to inform your perspective going forward? Are you particularly interested? For example, like, will you watch them just to say, like,
I was very interested. I didn't watch. I had other things going on. You know, I lived it a little, Terry. When I was at Hopkins, we'd scrimmage Hobart every year. Dave Urich would bring the group down. They were one of our scrimmages, and you know, they were as good as anyone we played. They competed with a ferocity and gave us everything we can handle in that scrimmage. We also played Washington College every year in a March midweeker. I think I made my first appearance against Washington College coming off the bench. As good as a middle tier Division I team back then. I played club for years with guys off of these teams, whether it was Ohio Wesleyan and Kevin Finneran, whether it was Washington College, whether it was F&M, and their best players were world class. Their best players that make Team USAs. So I have a high respect for the great player in D3. I have a huge respect for the great teams, because they're if they were D1, they'd be kind of right in the thick of things and probably in the middle of the pack somewhere.
All right, Quinn, I just want one more kind of celebration of the moment to end this podcast, because this is just one of those weekends that makes you realize this is why I fell in love with the game all those years ago. So a final thought, even though you were in your basement as opposed to standing on top of a concrete press box at Homewood Field and standing, I don't even know where the press box is, in Ann Arbor. But despite that, how glad are you to have been able to experience the weekend that you did?
Well, you know, it's hard for me not to get a little emotional, actually. Sorry. There are so many people behind the scenes at our company who have gone out of their way to get these games on the air. Katie is our producer at Duke, and I remember that first Duke game, the Duke-Virginia game. They've done such great work. I'm in my office doing three games this week. Able to do, you know, Hopkins-Maryland game. I'm overwhelmed, and you're going to have to cut this because I'm losing it. I'm exhausted, but it's just, there's so many people who have gone out of their way on our team. The same with the teams who are competing every Saturday that you see. The trainers, the medical advisors, the people behind the scenes. It's so humbling to be on a team that's all in on getting these games on TV. For us to have that game-winning goal in overtime. And to see these kids celebrate, to see a dog pile, you know, at Penn State last week was a great moment. To watch Hopkins and Maryland fight over a trophy, to get pictures from an Army-Navy game from fans. I'm sorry, it's
awesome. I mean, it's why we do what we do. Yeah. I think back to the column that you wrote on March 8th of 2020, and you were traveling more than a lot of people. And as a result, you were more aware of the threat that COVID represented than many people. And in that column, you said something to the effect of make responsible choices, wash your hands, all that sort of thing. You never know when you're going to get it taken away. I mean, I remember thinking you were being a little alarmist. We didn't take it out, right? We didn't say like, oh no, this like shouldn't be in there. And you didn't get an opportunity to write another column in 2020. So as the season reaches its crescendo, it is absolutely justifiable to get emotional at the idea of it hurt really bad to miss it. Now, it did, but at the same time, missing something is always different from savoring something when it's present, because when you miss it, you don't really know what you're missing. Only now are we confronted with everything we missed last year. And so only now, having missed it, can we really appreciate not only the fact that it's back, but also that we don't have to deal once again with the sadness of having missed it last year.
Yeah, and it's not perfect. I mean, you know, to see a Duke game with no fans and to think of the parents of those players who can't go in person and watch their sons compete, I can't imagine their frustration. To see teams have to shut down, just unfortunate, you know, to come this far. To think about what it's like to travel on one of these teams, you know, whether it be in multiple buses, whether you're in a hotel isolated by yourself, whether your team's really not able to eat together as a group. So there's tremendous sacrifices. It's very different. It's very muted. And so that I think when the game starts, the game's not muted. Nothing's changed in the game. And that's what's made this for me so special, because everyone's been dealing with it. Everyone's trying to find solutions. People are coming up, have excuses. But when that whistle blows and there's two teams out there, it's like, here we go. Everything's back to normal. And that, those 60 minutes are still very normal. I sense more camaraderie from teams. I sense the celebrations are a little more special this year. I sense when guys come off the bench and make contributions, it's like, I think these teams, I think these student athletes, I think these coaches, I think long-term, this is going to be just a major, major year for us and lacrosse to always look back at.
It's been great, but the best part about it is it's only going to get better for the next 5-6 weeks. So, Quint, as always, we appreciate your time on the Quick Restart podcast. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and a review, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcast.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.